listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight we discuss the classic film, The Graduate, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. There's a new book about the film by Beverly Gray. Beverly Gray is a veteran of the film industry, having worked for Roger Corman, whom she wrote a book about, and she's the author of a book about Ron Howard, and she's contributed to Hollywood Reporter, and she's an educator, and her new book is Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How The Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. Beverly Gray, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
I'm very pleased to be with you.
I love the book. I think it's a great book about a classic and important film, but since you and I are just meeting here for the first time, I want to know more about you and how you got into the film industry and how you came to work for Roger Corman.
Well, that is quite a story, and it certainly took me by surprise. I was in graduate school studying contemporary American fiction, and somewhere along the line, I decided that even though I loved writing academic papers, I also liked the idea that I could write the kind of things that everyday people might read. So I started writing movie reviews for the UCLA Daily Bruin, this campus paper. And out of that, one day, I got a call from a professor who was a friend of mine who had been approached by this man I had never heard of, whose name was Roger Corman. And he wanted me to come in and interview for a job as his assistant, which I did, first boning up on who he was and racking my brains to try to remember if I'd ever seen one of his biker flicks or monster movies or Edgar Allan Poe classics, which I probably hadn't. I really wasn't that type of person. And when I came into his office for the first time, he said to me, and you'll have to pardon me because everyone who's ever worked for Roger does the Roger Corman invitation. You just can't get away from it. So, Beverly, I would be happy to cooperate with you. If I hire you, I would like you to promise me to read Siegfried Krakauer's Theory of Film, and we'll discuss it. So, of course, I went home and I read this very esoteric film book by Siegfried Krakauer on his theory of film, and I got the job, and I kept waiting to have this intellectual discussion with Roger Corman, and it never happened.
So he gave you a homework assignment for which there was no follow-up.
Right. But that showed you something about Roger. On the one hand, he made movies with names like The Big Birdcage and Angels Heart as They Come and things of that nature. And yet, in his heart of hearts, I think he liked hanging out with intellectuals and thinking intellectual thoughts. So hence, he turned to UCLA PhD students for assistance.
And you started working for him in what capacity?
I started working at New World Pictures. My title was assistant, but basically I did a whole lot of different things. It was a very small company, and I did some casting. I worked on some productions. I mostly worked with scripts. I did some sort of bookkeeping kinds of things, and one day he said, Beverly, take a letter. So I did it all, and later, the company got bigger and a little more stratified in terms of who did what. But in those early days, if you were there, you were going to do just about anything, and it was quite an education.
And had you had ambitions in the film industry at all?
In a word, no, I hadn't. My dream for myself was to be an academic, to be a professor of English. I thought that was a nice, dignified place for me to land. I imagined teaching at some ivy-covered cottage somewhere, you know, great works of literature. And I didn't really expect to be making B-movies. And my life really has ended up being a kind of fluctuation between those two poles. And I kind of like that, of making, on the one hand, writing intellectually. I've got that background. But on the other hand, occasionally dealing with and possibly turning out schlock. So it's been a fun ride.
Well, obviously you have you know, like a flair for analyzing film. I mean, this book that we're going to discuss, Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation, Beverly Gray, it's not just a book about a movie, but you really give an in-depth analysis of the film. I mean, practically scene by scene, frame by frame. I mean, you really have an eye for that.
Thank you. I like that part of the book a lot. Not everyone agrees with me. They say, well, I've seen the movie. But it seems to me that there's so much you miss unless you look closely. Mike Nichols was a real master. There are some very interesting and amusing and thought-provoking things that went into the making of that movie. And I wanted to make sure that my readers got it all.
Do you think symbolism in a movie, in The Graduate or in any film, has to be intended? Do you think there can be unintended symbolism and that the symbolism is there nevertheless?
I think so. I know that some of those things definitely were deliberate, and in a way, Mike Nichols and his production designer, Richard Silver, people like that, were doing things almost for their own amusement. Of course, film is a very expensive medium, so you don't do things only for your own amusement, but all the water, all the glass, all the reflective surfaces, they were very amused by the suggestions of narcissism, of mirror images of Benjamin being, as we see him in his first scene in his parents' home, in front of a large aquarium of tropical fish. Now, that's not in the script. It's not in the novel. But it fits exactly with Benjamin's situation as someone who is like a handsome tropical fish on display in his parents' home with all of his parents' friends oohing and aahing, and Benjamin amongst them and yet cut off from them, detached from them. It works perfectly, and that kind of sense of him looked at but enclosed and cut off happens throughout the movie, like in the swimming pool where he's in that scuba suit and everybody is oohing and aahing over him. You see him in a glassed-in phone booth, if you can remember phone booths. We used to have them. All those things were definitely deliberate. But Mike Nichols would be the first to say that people find things in movies that weren't necessarily put there, that there are ideas that people take away from movies that weren't deliberate on the part of the filmmaker. And, of course, one of those ideas was the idea of that film fitting into what was going on in the heads of young people in the year 1967.
Well, how do you... I mean, you don't think they intended the film to fit into that moment?
No, they really didn't. They were very... And that I had very specifically from the producer, Larry Turmitt. I asked him. I said, what year did you have in mind when you were making the film? What was the look of the film? He said, you know, we never gave that any thought at all. We thought of it as contemporary, of course, or maybe kind of the year that the novel was set in. There is a novel, and it was written in 1962, published in 1963. But 1963 and 1967, if you were a young baby boomer just getting out of college, those were very different eras. There was a lot going on in our heads in 67 we weren't worrying so much about in 1963.
Yeah.
And, of course, the big thing that was different was the war in Vietnam.
Which is not in the film at all.
No. And it's just almost accidental that it struck that kind of a nerve. Not 100% incidental, because there were some drafts of the script where they tried to put in a little bit of language, and there was actually, in one of Buck Henry's drafts, there was a scene where Ben comes out of a hamburger joint and he sees this young soldier admiring his fancy sports car, and it turns out this kid went to high school with him, but he was one of the dumb kids, the self-proclaimed dumb kids, who got shipped off to Vietnam while the smart kids went off to college. And it was heavy-handed. It just really didn't work, and wisely they struck that from the script, so that the script still works. The movie still works, whatever era it's set in. But if you saw the movie in 1967, you knew that, you know, the draft was breathing down your neck, and you didn't stop to ponder why it wasn't breathing down Benjamin Braddock's neck. It certainly is not, because there was a very big change that was made right while they were making the film. While they were shooting, President Johnson signed a Selective Service Act, a revamped Selective Service Act, which suddenly said that nobody, with very few exceptions, was allowed to have more than 4 years of college. You couldn't stretch out your college years. Grad school was something you could consider after you did military service. So that was an enormous change for an awful lot of young men, and of course young women who are concerned about young men. And out of that change, which occurred right at the time the film was being shot, there were some emotions that were really starting to roil. That's when the protests against the war really stepped up. So by the time the movie came out in December 1967, just 50 years ago, tomorrow, there was a tremendous amount of emotion that young people were feeling and seeing this movie. But it is not specific, and that's one reason it can still be seen and enjoyed, and it doesn't look dated in the way that some other movies, which are very specifically trying to play on the emotions of a particular time. Those are period pieces. A movie like Elliot Goulding Getting Straight, which is about Vietnam and is about campus protests, nobody sees that movie anymore, and they certainly do continue to watch The Graduate.
Or even Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which was also nominated that year for Best Picture.
Yeah. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is a very interesting film, and I've spent a certain amount of time studying it and talking to Stanley Kramer's widow about it. My favorite review of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is one in which some guy on a paper in, I think, Topeka, Kansas, said this movie could not have been made 5 years ago, and 5 years from now it'll look ridiculous. In other words, it, again, a huge success, came out at exactly the right time, and The Graduate as well.
Well, I love The Graduate, and I've seen it many, many times, and one scene I've never seen in The Graduate is the scene that's on the cover of your book. Where did you find this? Where did you find this photograph? That's obviously not from the film. It's a publicity picture of some kind.
Yes. Well, it's not such a secret. There was a photographer named Bob Willoughby who was hired to take promotional shots, and several that are in the book were taken in those situations where, you know, let's get the actors and let's kind of mock up what things are going to look like. So if you look at it, it's a hilarious picture. The picture on the cover, for those who aren't looking at it right now, is of Ben and Mrs. Robinson in bed. She's looking very proud of herself, very much in control. He's looking a little dazed and confused. It's a teeny, teeny bed, and if you look at it closely, there's a TV on with cartoons. It's a funny picture when you look at it. So, yes, it is not in the movie.
It's interesting because you can see what great actors Anne Bancroft and Dustin Hoffman are, even in this still picture. They're conveying
right,
so
they
much.
Are definitely in character.
And she's wearing her leopard print underpants.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And you talked about a lot about the motif of animal skins with her.
Yeah, well, as an English major type myself, I love discovering that Mike Nichols got the idea, and this is another case where he very deliberately made a choice. He was reading Henry James. He was reading the novella The Beast in the Jungle, and that is a story by Henry James which uses the idea of a beast springing only metaphorically. There are no actual beasts running around in any actual literal jungle within that story. It's a very English drawing room kind of story, but the imaginative idea of a beast attracted him, and he decided that Mrs. Robinson was a kind of beast in the jungle and should have woven into her clothes both her underwear and even very subtly in some of her dresses and suits and hats. Sometimes it's blatant, sometimes it's very, very low-key. There are animal spots, animal stripes, there are leopard patterns, there are giraffe patterns, zebra stripes, until she kind of gets her comeuppance, and then she loses some of that. But through most of the film, she is the beast in the jungle, and of course she's set against a kind of backdrop, and she hangs out on the sun porch of her house, and the backdrop is all of these tropical plants, which are photographed in such a way that they look particularly lurid, and as has been said, white hot. So he is really playing around with that idea in a very interesting way. I mean, this was a movie, Mike Nichols was brand new to filmmaking when he made this movie, took a lot of his ideas from the great filmmakers of Europe, was doing things that Hollywood really hadn't tried to do. And of course, they're brilliant.
KSCO, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tonight we're talking with Beverly Gray about the classic film The Graduate. She's the author of a book, Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. There had been, you know, I guess some anti-heroes before Benjamin Braddock and Dustin Hoffman. I mean, you mentioned in your book Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke, and I think Brando to a certain extent in The Wild One. But never an anti-hero like Dustin Hoffman. I mean, those guys were physically attractive. And although I think Dustin Hoffman is really cute in the movie. He's not really what you would think of as a movie star.
No, and that's important, too. And it was really one of the innovations of this production. Mike Nichols searched and searched and searched for the right guy. In fact, I love this fact that he was getting so discouraged that an article appeared in the New York Times saying that whoever got this role was sure to become a star, but they just hadn't found the right person. At which point, half of the young college graduates in America started pestering the casting office. You know, I graduated from college, and gosh, I starred in my school play, etc. And a lot of moms also sent in pictures of their sons, which I found really endearing. So all of these amateurs wanted the part, not quite knowing what it was all about. And a lot of young actors just starting out wanted the part. And I love the names of some of them. Edward Herman, Harvey Keitel, all of these people were after the part. But it finally narrowed down to six professional actors, each of whom spent a day on the set in makeup with someone playing Elaine Robinson and performing a quite a lengthy scene, a lot of dialogue on film. And amongst them was the person that everybody seemed to think had the inside track, and that was a young man named Robert Redford. When people read the novel by Charles Webb, The Graduate, there is no description. But everybody comes away from that novel assuming that anybody who's a campus hero type, who student body officer and great academic success story and captain of the cross-country team, who's got all of these various skills, has got to be a Robert Redford type, tall, maybe blonde, you know, good-looking, in a classic kind of way. So that was the assumption. And the reason that Robert Redford seemed to particularly have the inside track was because he had just finished starring for Mike Nichols in Mike Nichols' breakout role as a stage director. That was Barefoot in the Park, where he played a young married, very successful production on Broadway. And Mike Nichols and Robert Redford certainly had respect for one another, so it seemed obvious. And there's a story I'm very, very fond of, although who knows if it's true, but it's a great story, that that Robert Redford went through this whole process, and it just didn't seem like the role was going to fall his way. And he said to Mike Nichols, "Well, why don't you cast me already?" And Nichols said, "Well, let me put it this way, Bob. When is the last time you ever struck out with a girl?" And Redford said, "What do you mean?" And in that answer, Mike Nichols had his answer, that here was somebody who was so attractive, so confident, that it didn't seem like he would be the appropriate star over this particular comedy, that you wanted someone more hapless. So a lot of other people tried out for the role. They said it was down to six. One of them was Charles Grodin. One of them was Tony Bill, who had done some romantic comedy parts on film and ended up producing The Sting, interestingly enough, winning an Oscar. And the last of the six was Dustin Hoffman. He was not an absolute nobody. If you followed the off-Broadway stage and the occasional odd little TV role, he played quirky parts, usually parts with strange makeup and accents, and not a guy who was known for his handsome looks. He preferred parts where he, you know, had a limp and he had an accent and he was a transvestite, all those kinds of things. So he didn't really think that he was right for the part, and apparently said so to Mike Nichols and said, I don't see how I could play Benjamin Braddock. And Mike Nichols said, I know what you're worrying about, but think of it this way, maybe he's Jewish inside. And that was a very interesting remark from Mike Nichols, whose own background as a refugee from Nazi Germany is, I think, really something that's behind a lot of what went into the making of this film. Mike Nichols knew what it was like to be the odd man out, to be an outsider, and he wanted to bring that characteristic to this part. And in Dustin Hoffman, he felt he found the right guy. And the result of it was that there was a kind of a tidal shift in Hollywood, because when the movie first came out, people were coming up to the production team and saying, and I'm talking about Hollywood insider types, they'd see an industry screening and they'd come away and they'd walk up to Larry Terman, the producer, or Mike Nichols, the director, and they'd say, "Well, you made a great movie. It's just a shame that you miscast the lead." And they really thought of Dustin Hoffman in so many words as ugly. The word ugly was used over and over again. And it was even used in print. There was one article in Life magazine, which was had a big headline that said, now this is an article promoting this new actor and promoting this movie, which hadn't quite come out yet. And it said, "A swarthy Pinocchio makes a wooden role real." And it says, I think the opening line of this article is, "If Dustin Hoffman's face were his fortune, he would be committed to a life of poverty." So people were trying awfully hard, as creatively as they could, to say, this is an ugly guy. And which, to me, is always a surprise, because I think he's kind of an adorable guy. But classically handsome, no, but endearing. Young people didn't care what was said in Life magazine. They didn't care what was said in Hollywood circles. They identified with this guy in a way maybe they couldn't possibly have identified with the Robert Redford. And they, in his confusion and his haplessness, they saw themselves.
Well, you know, I remember watching The Graduate for the first time in when it came out, and thinking halfway through the picture, what I first thought was a peculiar looking guy is really, I really identify with him and I really think he's great. And the same thing happened, I think, the same year, maybe a few months later, when Funny Girl came out and I first saw Barbra Streisand. I thought, oh, she's ridiculous looking. And then halfway through the picture, thinking, she's so beautiful, I love her. So it's kind of interesting that that was kind of an era in which it was possible for that to happen in Hollywood for the first time.
In the case of Dustin Hoffman, he started an interesting trend where suddenly ethnic was in an important way, and he was followed by a long line of actors in romantic parts, people like Richard Dreyfuss, Charles Grodin, Elliot Gould, Richard Benjamin, and some Italian types too, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro. Barbra Streisand still stands alone. There was not a whole string of women who were allowed to have looks that were as quirky and unclassical as Barbra Streisand.
There's always a double standard in Hollywood, huh?
I just said it's unfortunate for women.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, there's always a double standard in Hollywood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you talk about him being Jewish inside, and we hear his interior voice as sung through the words of Simon and Garfunkel. And of course, Paul Simon is a little Jewish man too, not unlike
right.
Dustin Hoffman physically. And before The Graduate, whenever there was music in a movie, it was either music that was written for that movie or kind of fake music. You know, whenever somebody turned on the radio, there's like not real music that you could, because you know, they wouldn't ever pay any royalties for any music that already existed. And The Graduate was the first to actually just have a record that everybody knew playing in the background.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. There is a little bit of that by the way sorts of music by a man named Dave Grusin, and I like to give him credit. He wrote when Mrs. Robinson snaps on the hi-fi or the...
And that crazy music comes on. It's like
over-the-top
romantic.
Sun Porch Cha-Cha-Cha. I mean, they're great titles for those little pieces. But obviously most of the music is by Simon and Garfunkel. And not only is it by Paul Simon, but it's played over and over and over again in a way that's very unusual. And it was not... Well, one piece was composed for the movie, and of course that was the piece Mrs. Robinson, which is not even a whole tune. It comes very late in the film, and a little snatch of a tune which was later expanded and completed. But it was just a little bit of music. Most of the music that you hear in the film is The Sound of Silence, which opens the movie, which is used extensively in a long, wordless montage in the middle of the movie, and certainly comes on very importantly at the end of the movie as that bus goes down the road. So that had already been written by Paul Simon. Mike Nichols had discovered Paul Simon's music through his brother, who had sent him an album, which he found himself playing over and over again. Of course, music is always added to films very, very late in the game. And when it was time to edit the movie, especially because it had this montage that needed to be cut to some kind of music, they were using The Sound of Silence. They were using Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. They were using April Come, She Will, briefly. Those songs that already existed. And suddenly it occurred to Mike Nichols that instead of using those as temp tracks, let's just use them. Let's pay whatever we have to pay and use this music. And the financier of the movie, a guy named Joseph E. Levine, was just horrified. He said, you can't do that. He said, everyone's going to laugh at you if you use music that's been out. These old songs, kids will laugh at you. I think it's funny that he called them old songs because they were possibly 2 years old. But in any case, they were known. And Mike Nichols decided this was the right music. He wanted to use it, and he did. And, of course, what happened was something quite unexpected and wonderful is that young people who knew and loved that music and who felt it was kind of the voice of their generation brought those emotions into the theater with them. So as soon as that music came on, their emotions started taking over. Their feelings about that music started taking over. It turned out to be a very valuable technique, and it certainly has been used ever since. The one that occurs to me immediately was a few years later with American Graffiti, where when that late 50s, early 60s music kicks in, we all know where we are and what we went through when we were the age to hear those songs.
And now there's a whole slew of people out there trying to get their artists' music heard in movies. It's like a thing now. Every movie has a contemporary
Absolutely,
story.
And movies and television as well. It's a very common technique now, and this is kind of where it started.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light to split the night the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did disturb the sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows.
This is KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. Tonight we're talking with Beverly Gray. She's the author of Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. The movie had a certain feeling and impact for us who saw it in 1968, but people who see it now, I think, have a different reaction to it. Have you found that? Do you think the characters and the story have a different resonance now?
I do, in several different ways. First of all, there are people who saw it back in the day and see it again now and find they're watching it from a different perspective. And I think that is really interesting. I know certainly it's the way I feel. When I saw the movie in 1967, of course, I wasn't personally worried about the draft, but I was certainly worried about the way my parents were, with all the best of intentions, trying so hard to shape my adult life. That's what was really bugging me then, and those party scenes at the beginning where the parents are telling Ben exactly what they expect of him and where what they expect him to do with his good grades and his talents, I certainly identified with that. Nowadays, when I see The Graduate, I can understand the parents in a whole different way because I am one. And I can understand what they're probably going through and see the younger characters through a different lens. So that's one thing that happens, that depending on where you are in life, you'll see it differently. And one character you might focus on, which you may not have focused on so much at the beginning, is Mrs. Robinson. The woman who did what society expected of her, got married, had children, you know, especially dealt with an unwanted pregnancy by quickly getting married and forming a household, and found that this was the most miserable of compromises and one that had to be dealt with somehow. So I think women in particular focus on her character, and maybe a few of people saw that back in the day. Certainly more see it now when they watch the film.
What do you think Mrs. Robinson's motivations are in the film?
Well, I think what her motivations are is intense. She's acting out of an intense kind of disappointment and a sense of being trapped. The key scene is the one where they try to have a conversation and he finds out that her college major was art, but she's not interested in it now, that he says, I guess you lost interest, and she says, I guess so. Well, he also finds out in that same conversation the reason why she married Mr. Robinson, the man she's been cuckolding probably left and right. I don't think Ben is her first conquest. This is a woman who got married because she got pregnant. And that was a compromise she had to make. No matter how comfortable her life is, and it is a very comfortable life, I mean, she's got money, she's got a certain amount of status, she's got a beautiful daughter, but she is a very unhappy person, and she's going to act on that however she can. And I once had a conversation about something like that with my OBGYN, believe it or not. He actually knew Anne Bancroft, and so we would talk about the film. And I said, how common do you think it is that women who are unhappy in their marriage would react in this way by sort of sleeping around with whoever comes into their purview? And he said, you would not believe how common that is. And I guess he would know. I think her motives are understandable. And Anne Bancroft's performance is such that you are amused by her. You think she's hilariously funny in some ways. And you feel profoundly sad for her, too.
Well, that's one of the great things about the movie, isn't it? Is that it's a very, very funny tragedy.
Exactly. And then there's the question of the ending of it. Is it a happily ever after movie? That depends on who you talk to. And I've talked to a lot of people who remembered seeing it when they were 16 or 17 or 18 years old and saw the ending as a triumph. Certainly, that was the dominant mood in theaters in that era. When everybody I've talked to who's worked on the movie said they've never been involved in another production like it, where the audience was stamping and cheering, and they couldn't get enough of this rebellious ending. So, happy ending? Well, there they are on the bus, and what comes across in their faces is exuberance and happiness and joy and amusement and perplexity and confusion and maybe a little bit of dread, too.
And where are they going? And they don't have anything with them. And
exactly. And she's legally married to somebody else, and they are facing a mess. And it's not going to be fun to sort it out.
Yes, it's interesting that he doesn't arrive in the nick of time. He arrives just after the nick of time.
And that was Mike Nichols' idea. He thought it up, and then apparently, according to Larry Turman, sort of backed away and said, well, maybe we shouldn't do that, because it was considered really shocking. There was a whole long history of movies where the hero arrives in the nick of time, going all the way back to Harold Lloyd and silent movies. But here he arrives after the nick of time. She is married, and yet she runs off with him. And a lot of people, including a lot of people with some moral authority, shall we say, clergyman types, politician types, people were making sermons and editorials about this. They were very upset.
Well, what made you decide to return to the film now and write about it? Was it that it was its 50th birthday or what?
Well, it never hurts, first of all, that it's a big anniversary. But I started out quite a while ago, about 10 years ago. I was very interested in that whole year, 1967, because it was a year I remembered when the Oscar ceremony, which we used to watch, I think, a great deal more seriously than perhaps we do now, at least I feel that way, there were some really important movies. And there had been, of course, important and interesting and enjoyable movies before, but, you know, the Oscar was going to things like Ben-Hur and The Man for All Seasons, and, you know, those are good movies, but 1967, the Oscar ceremony for 1968, those were movies that seemed to really say something about the here and now, about the issues the country was facing. And I'm talking, aside from The Graduate, about Bonnie and Clyde, about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, you mentioned, In the Heat of the Night, Cool Hand Luke. That was a year when it seemed that Hollywood was open to looking at what's going on in the here and now. So that was an important year for me, and I wanted to write about it. Unfortunately, other people wanted to write about it too, and it, for various complicated reasons, my book on that subject never worked out. And when I kind of picked up the pieces from that project and said, well, now what do I do? I realized that one film that hadn't really fully gotten explored in the way that I wanted to explore it was The Graduate. There was a lot to say that other people hadn't said it, that the movie, I thought, was much more interesting and complicated than it was given credit for. And it all came together.
And it came together incredibly well. The book is called...
I appreciate it.
Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation, and the author, my guest, Beverly Gray. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, there is nothing I like better than talking about my books, as you probably can tell, except maybe talking about one of my favorite movies.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Beverly Gray. Her new book is called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.